Jacksonville saw serious historic flooding in the wake of Hurricane Irma last year. Could rising river levels see that happen again? And are we prepared? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a look ahead to tonight's town hall meeting, one of many planned around town to talk about the dangers of rising water levels in the St. Johns River. You can get on the line now and join us at 549-2937. Then later, it's our Art Attack on the show, a look at local art and the First Amendment. Plus, Carrie Speckman on World Selfie Day. It's today. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, well, we all remember last September when Hurricane Irma slammed into Florida. Here on the First Coast, the storm came on the heels of a nor'easter offshore, and that combination created record flooding in Jacksonville, particularly downtown and in the historic river-hugging neighborhoods of Riverside and San Marco. People across the city are still not recovered from that. Nationwide, the cost of the damages from Irma reached nearly $10 billion. Now, shortly after Irma went through, the Tampa Bay Times published a report showing that the city of Jacksonville is woefully unprepared for even a weak hurricane. And in the wake of Irma, nearly a year later, city officials have done little to prevent more widespread flooding from occurring again. And on top of that, there are new studies showing more dredging in the St. Johns River could lead to even bigger storm surges the next time a big hurricane rolls through. So against this backdrop, the St. Johns Riverkeeper is holding a series of town hall meetings to educate people about the dangers of rising water levels. The first town hall, called River Rising, is tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Sunray Cinema in Five Points. Here with a preview, we welcome Shannon Blankenship, Advocacy Director, and Kelly Patton, Outreach Director, both with the St. Johns Riverkeeper. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
What are your concerns, callers, about rising waters, both in the St. Johns River and the ocean? We're going to take a look ahead to tonight's town hall, River Rising. Storm season is upon us. What are your concerns about the city's lack of preparation, frankly, to protect neighborhoods along the water if we get hit with that type of storm surge in the future? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax and weigh in as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Shannon Blankenship, let's begin with you. This first town hall is tonight, and it's one of many. What's on the agenda?
So the impetus for really deciding that we needed to take this conversation and open it up to the community was the article As the Ocean Creeps In by Times Union reporters Nate Monroe and Chris Hong. And I know that you had them on the show and were able to talk about a lot of the incredible information that they were able to bring to light based on that special report. Some of the findings that they highlighted were that the St. Johns River in its downtown area resembles the Atlantic more than any other time in its past. The river has been deepened, it's been channelized, and it's been straightened for the majority of its history that we've been here. And because of that, we're seeing in our downtown area a river that is saltier, that has higher tidal surges, and that has higher and faster currents. And because of that, we really need to take a look at and explore whether or not we're ready for the next Hurricane Irma. If we're not, what we can do about that. And so we have the authors of that article, Nate Monroe and Chris Hong, as well as other experts on the subject, to be able to answer those questions and to be able to talk about what does Jacksonville need to do, what are other cities doing, what can we all do, and what are our concerns moving forward.
What is Jacksonville doing, Kelly Patton, or not doing to protect neighborhoods from the kind of storm surge we saw after Hurricane Irma?
Well, I think
one of the many reasons why we wanted to engage with the community and have a wider conversation is the fact that Jacksonville is really not talking about this issue. You know, there's a lot of language out there about Jax is on the rise, but we really need to recognize that our river is also on the rise. And the lessons that we learned from Hurricane Irma in its wake and the aftermath is that we need to engage with the community more. And I think it's really important to recognize that we need to have a clear understanding about how we talk about sea level rise and rising waters and engage with the community and connect with them on what's real to them and how inches matter and sharing their stories. And so that'll be a big part of our town hall series tonight is giving, you know, raising awareness about the issues, having experts on hand to provide increasing their knowledge on the issues, but also giving the community the ability to ask questions that have been on their mind since Hurricane Irma last year and sharing stories that happen in their backyard.
The River Rising Town Hall, the first of several, is tonight in Five Points. Tell us if you're still dealing with the aftermath of flooding, by the way, if you're listening out there after Irma last year, if you're still trying to get insurance reimbursements. We want to hear your stories at 549-2937. So, Shannon, it's been almost a year since that flood. This building where we sit here at WJCT was surrounded by water, as were so many other downtown buildings, buildings in the historic neighborhoods. Nearly a year later, what do we know about what the city of Jacksonville has done to prepare for another historic flooding event? And have you had conversations with the city about the information that you'll be presenting when it comes to dredging the river, channelizing the river, and how that is anticipated to create more severe flooding in the future?
Yes, we have. And I can say, you know, St. John's Riverkeeper for the last 5 years has been raising the alarm about what the impacts of further deepening the St. John's River from 40 to 47 feet will mean. But what we know from this article and from the outcome of our lawsuit trying to stop or halt the,
which you basically lost.
Well, we lost, but one of the things we found out in this lawsuit that came out of the Army Corps of Engineers was the recognition that the river will rise by 12% based on this project moving forward. What we saw in the article is what that equates to is 3 to 6 inches, up to 8 inches on our coastlines in our downtown area. And we know from Irma that inches matter. Most people who were impacted, this building as well as so many other areas, 1 to 2 inches is significant. 3 to 8 inches is the difference between having significant property loss or significant loss of so many other things. You know, there's a lot that happens if we're going to allow this project to move forward. There's a lot that we're not yet mitigating for. And so one of the things that we need to have a conversation about, not just in preparing and being more resilient, is what kinds of mitigation can we require if we're going to allow this project to move forward to fortify our community, to fortify Jacksonville, to fortify our river against the impacts we know will happen from this project.
What are some mitigation steps the city should be taking, in your view?
So looking at what maybe a lot of other cities are doing to prepare for rising waters, things that we could be doing here, the city of Palm Beach County is looking at restoring oyster reefs, replanting mangroves. Broward County is looking to remove septic tanks from areas that will be impacted by sea level rise. Cities like New York and New Jersey creating living shorelines and breakwaters, projects that will try to halt this incoming surge. In our area, in Jacksonville, what we could be looking at are improvements to our tributaries that are already seeing sediment issues and impairments for so many reasons, looking at restoring those, restoring our grasses, restoring oyster beds, trying to be more resilient in the area that we know will be impacted by this project to to prepare us moving forward. And those are the kinds of projects that we should be seeing that we're not seeing. There are, though, I should highlight some really great things happening in Jacksonville. One of them, the Jacksonville Zoo, is installing a living shoreline, doing exactly what we're talking about, taking away the riprap that allows for shoreline erosion, removing that so that those native grasses can reemerge, adding submerged reefs, adding oyster beds, all of these things to reduce that impact from surge, from waves, from currents to the shoreline and restore it. We also are seeing the developers of the Living Breakline Project in New York are actually developers that were hired here locally to look at the restoration of the McCoy's Creek segment of the Emerald Necklace. That project's being spearheaded by Groundworks Jacksonville. So we have some really innovative, some really tremendous talent here in our city looking at what we could be doing moving forward. It's not connected, though, to resiliency. It could be, and that could be more of a push to elaborate on these projects, to expand them, to have more funding.
These are sort of siloed private initiative projects, though. These aren't city projects.
No.
That's the difference.
It is the difference. And I think when you look at the cities that are really on the cutting edge of saying, what are we going to do to protect our community? What are we going to do to protect our infrastructure? You know, they're taking a holistic look at these issues. So Jacksonville could be doing the same thing. And we hope that these town halls are going to allow us to start that conversation.
Kelly.
Yeah, I'll just add to that I think, you know, one of the ways that we can measure our success in these town halls is how many people have we encouraged and empowered to use their voices to connect with our city officials. You know, during hurricane season, we always talk about the short-term preparedness, going to the grocery store, getting our shopping lists ready, barricading our homes and evacuating. But are our city officials hearing the same message that they're telling us? And how are we going to prepare for something that's going to happen in 50 years? So tonight, and in the next three town halls, I think that call to action is so important. And, you know, it's more powerful coming from the community than from experts already in the field and environmental groups. And so I think that our role as an advocacy organization is really building up that grassroots effort. And we hope that the people that come tonight, it's open and free to everybody, will leave with a clear understanding and a way that they can go and lead it themselves.
And right now it's a preview of tonight's town hall, River Rising in Five Points, the first of several. What are your thoughts? Give us a call. 549-2937. Let's go to Dave up in Nassau County right now. Hi, Dave. Hey, Dave, are you there? I think we've got a bad connection.
Hello,
with Dave.
No, you haven't lost me. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you yet.
Hi, Dave, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I think one of the biggest problems that we're facing is that we've got a governor, a senator, and a Senate candidate who all deny climate science and are all essentially being shills for the fossil fuel industry. Even our own representative here is a denier of climate science. And until you get that particular block removed from our governing bodies, we're not really going to make a whole heck of a lot of progress in this area.
Dave, thanks for that. Shannon, you're talking about the effects of dredging the river, which have been touted by the city's business community as a real economic driver for this area, bringing jobs. Your organization, the Riverkeeper, has opposed that due to these impacts that you've been discussing. But what about Dave's comment? As we look at the related issue of rising oceans, that's going to push more water through the river basin and endanger inland neighborhoods. And what about his point that we do not have a state led by officials at this time, for the most part, that is getting ahead of this issue of mitigating and protecting our coastline against rising oceans?
Sure. So, well, luckily we live in a democracy and elections are in November and everything's on the table when it comes to our state. One of the things that is interesting about, you know, working on highlighting the issues that we anticipate we will see if we allow this dredging project to move forward for the last 5 years is that we are constantly hearing from the community that this isn't a project that they want. A poll by Jacksonville University in 2016 showed that 51% of Jacksonville metro area does not want this project to move forward. And these town halls, I think, are another reason that we're highlighting even more issues, that allowing this project to move forward unmitigated isn't something that our community wants to bankroll. And so if we can have more people highlighting this issue, discussing it, and raising these concerns with not just the people running for office right now, but then again for city council next year, and for mayor next year, you know, these are things that people want to hear from. These are things that they want our elected leaders to take a leadership role on. And I hope that it works.
Let's go to Ike in Riverside. Hello, Ike. Ike, you're on the air. What's going on with our phones today? Ike, can you hear me? All right, Ike, give us a call back. But what his question was, Kelly Patton, is that talking about sea level rise is missing the point. He wanted to say that killing vegetation in the river is a more immediate problem. Will that come up tonight at the town hall?
It very well could. That's definitely involved in the conversation. So when we're talking about dredging the river from 40 to 47 feet, you know, there is science there. And as I hope that everyone has read As the Ocean Creeps In, and if not, we will have reporters there talking about that research tonight. But salt water is further going upriver. And so naturally that affects the native grasses that are in there as well.
Native grasses and also trees that line the riverbank. It affects the sort of barrier of the tree roots as well.
Absolutely. There's not a lot of trees on the shoreline are salt tolerant, but as flooding gets worse. And as we saw in Hurricane Irma, the crest and downtown where the river is a little bit more narrow was at 5.5 feet. And so as saltwater continues to come in, that'll be more of an issue with erosion and water creeping into our pipelines and having pollution issues as well.
And what would you both say to those listening to this discussion who this just isn't a top of mind issue for them? Maybe they don't like to see the algae blooms in the river. They don't like hearing the salt water is going to keep coming farther and farther in, and that could present some problems. But, you know, they just don't see it as the urgent matter that you do.
Again, you know, inches really matter in our community. We have so many waterfront residents, whether you live on the St. John's River or any of our tributaries. This project is allowing the ocean to move in more. It's allowing more salt. It's allowing more water. A 12% increase in the downtown area could be significant. This is daily. For people that are already seeing nuisance flooding, they should be very alarmed that we are not really looking at how are we going to mitigate against these impacts? How are we going to protect our community moving forward? So these are questions that I think deserve answers. These are questions that we've been hearing, and we want to be able to give a more public forum for more of these questions and more of these stories of what people are experiencing. I would say if you were not immediately impacted by Hurricane Irma, then ask yourself, would 3 to 8 inches, would that have impacted you more? Mm-hmm. And if you weren't impacted, I know that your neighbors were, because we all had someone nearby, down the street, down the road, a sibling, a mother, a father that were impacted by this storm. And we don't want to see a Hurricane Irma happen again.
Let's go to Emmett. He's along the Wonderwood Bridge right now. Hello, Emmett. Good morning to you. Go ahead.
Who is this?
Emmett, it's Melissa. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, what I have is I live on the marsh. I have an acre. I have an acre on the marsh, and I've lived here for 2 years. And when I came, we went through a hurricane, and I had pretty much a lot of the swamp up on my lawn. So I decided I'm trying on a one strip wood chips, and I put the wood chips in about 6 inches deep on my property. By the way, the EPA has been out and looked at this, and they loved it. Anyway, the wood chips go in, and after, I don't know how many months, maybe a year, they break down into a kind of a dirt, which the sea grasses love, the marsh grasses love, and they grow up strong in a nice, neat line. They're like landscape. The thing about it also is that in the second hurricane, because of the wind direction, I had 30 hours of trash removal from my lawn, stuff that came in from the marsh, because although the marshes are privately owned, they're not required to clean them up. So you have a lot of stuff in the marsh. Mm-hmm. So I've now put in 10 loads of wood chips, and the edge of the property is glorious. In other words, this is what the EPA looked at. the wood chips turn into a dirt. The marsh grasses eat them. I've got a 170-foot dock with a big oyster, an oyster reef, and the oysters grow up there. And the place is very healthy. We get two high tides every 24 hours. And what the wood chips also do is they filter the water.
Okay.
The stuff that's in the water when it comes in is left in the chips. And for some reason, the plants along there are now healthier than they've ever been. Among other things, I have 80-foot pine trees, 24 palm trees, which are different sizes.
And they're doing better. They're doing well. That's good to hear, Emmett.
They're healthy as can be.
Okay. I really appreciate that. That's interesting. And I'm going to look more into that. Thanks for that call, Emmett. That's Emmett out in the Wonderwood Bridge area. Let's go quickly to Mike in Palatka. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Yes, my concern, I was misinterpreted a little bit earlier. It's not Ike in the Riverside. It's Mike in Piccolotta.
Oh, okay.
My concern is that the Corps of Engineers and the St. Johns River Water Management District are boogering things up. They're taking the St. Johns Water Management District would like to take 270 million gallons of fresh water out of the river. And while the city of Jacksonville, as we've talked about with this dredging project, is going to force feed salt water practically down to Palatka and perhaps even further south, it's just not healthy. Also, the thing that I have noticed in the last 3 months is that both the Corps of Engineers and the St. John's Water Management District sprays the river for vegetation. Here in Piccolotta, we have always had an extremely healthy aquatic vegetation situation. Now there is nothing. There is absolutely nothing in the river 50 miles north, 50 miles south. I suspect that the reason we have no vegetation is because of aquatic spraying, aquatic growth spraying. And I would like to see what the river keeper says about
that. Sure. Okay.
I'd like to have somebody.
Thank you for that. That's Mike in Piccolotta. Kelly or Shannon?
So I want to speak specifically to the salinity issue that I think was one of the points he raised. You know, we've been raising the alarm on what an increase in salinity will mean for the St. John's, for the history of this proposed project. And we're not just talking about salinity at the mouth of the river. We're talking about salinity for the entire estuary of the St. John's, which reaches the Palatka area. One of the biggest impacts of that salinity will be an impact to those submerged aquatic grasses, which are the foundation of all of the life in our river. So if he's seeing impacts to his grasses, that means he's seeing impacts to the health of the river system in his area. Specifically to spraying, most of what we know about the spraying is that it is for controlled invasive species. That doesn't mean that there can't be unintended consequences. You know, we know that there are unintended consequences of use of chemicals and of course, from a lot of the man-made things that we're doing to alter our river. So that could be true. But, you know, salinity alone hasn't necessarily changed people's minds about whether or not they think this project is a good one or a bad one, but it should. But as well as salinity, really looking at storm surge, rising waters, you know, these are issues that I think hit all of us, whether or not we really care about those submerged grasses, the impacts to those trees that we're already seeing those salt burns. You know, I think that rising waters is another reason to sort of come together and ask ourselves, are we ready for the next big storm?
This is just a preview of tonight's free town hall at Sunray Cinema on Park Street in Five Points. It starts at 6:30 p.m., and it's the first of several. Thank you so much, Shannon Blankenship and Kelly Patton, both with the St. John's River Keeper. I'm sure you'll have a big turnout there tonight. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Well, much more still ahead later on the show. Guess what? Today is World Selfie Day. Find out how local selfie queen Carrie Speckman is trying to set a selfie world record. We'll tell you about it. But up next, we're continuing the discussion about climate change, extreme weather, and sea level rise. What I learned last week at the Metcalf Institute. I'll tell you about it right after this.
On the next Jazz Night in America... tracing the legendary Vanguard Jazz Orchestra back to its roots. We'll go underground to celebrate 50 years of innovative composition and tradition in the village.
It all started with a handshake, and now we're celebrating 50 years.
We're still operating on that same handshake.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, a live call-in program where you talk about the biggest stories in the state.
This Friday, outrage grows over families separated from their children at the southern border. What's the Florida connection? And what are immigration advocates in the Sunshine State doing to help the children?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, last week I had the incredible opportunity to be chosen as one of 10 fellows from around the nation and the world to attend the 20th annual Science Immersion Workshop for Journalists at the Metcalf Institute in Rhode Island. Now, this week of study on the University of Rhode Island campus gave me invaluable insights into the science behind climate change, extreme weather, sea level rise, and what we can expect here in Florida. I spoke about it with our news director, Jessica Palumbo.
So reading about your experience, Melissa, on our website, it sounds like the least relaxing way that you could spend a week on a boat.
That's about right. It was not a relaxing week, but it was a really impactful one. And not all of it on the boat, actually, a lot of it in classrooms. What this fellowship was a real immersion into science, particularly the science behind our warming world, extreme weather events like Hurricane Irma, our rising oceans, stronger storms, how scientists are trying to understand the drivers behind climate change and what we can honestly expect in the coming decades here in Florida and beyond. And so as someone who reports on this stuff for all of our listeners, as all of us do here at WJCT, it was really great to learn the latest science and be able to understand it a little better. And so at this Metcalf Institute at the University of Rhode Island, we did go out on a fish trawler. We did visit a salt marsh, but most of the time we were actually listening to seminars from really, you know, top shelf people in this field who were trying to educate us. So it was definitely a very worthwhile week.
Was there one piece of information you learned that you think will really change the way that you talk about these issues?
You know, I think that a lot of people continue to deny the science behind climate change, maybe because it's just scary to think about. But the one thing I came away with that I really want to stress is that even though no scientific theory is ever 100% certain, scientists are as certain about the link between carbon greenhouse gas emissions and climate change as they are about the link between smoking and lung cancer. It's as certain as it can be in science. And so I think it's time here in Florida, especially, to stop debating the science and instead moving to action and figuring out what municipalities should be doing, including Jacksonville, to prepare for rising oceans, more extreme weather, more extreme storms, more flooding. We're not prepared. And that's a big problem for this state.
There's lots you learned that is very depressing, but did you leave this experience with any hope at the end of it?
I guess the hope comes from cities. I think cities all over the world are just moving ahead on their own. And particularly since the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which is supposed to keep the world below a certain degree of warming to stave off the worst impacts of this. So many cities, including some here in Florida, are saying, we're going to do what we can do now to prepare our municipalities and to protect our citizenry. And I think that in the end, addressing this issue is going to have to come from lots of different city leaders, state leaders, business leaders working on this issue collectively, because we're not seeing the leadership here in Florida at the state level, I think that we probably need to be seeing on this. And governments working together around the world, I think, are trying to address this. But more and more, what we see is the corporate sector jumping in and using market forces to address climate change. So those are the things to watch.
We look forward to hearing how this experience informs your segments going forward. And this is a topic that the listeners know you're obviously very passionate about. We're proud of you having gotten this fellowship, Melissa.
Thank you. And in a moment, free speech. Our Art Attack panel looks at how art furthers it right here in town. That's after this.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
You've gotta have art.
All you really need is art. When those little things in life make you frown, come on down and get a start. First you gotta have art, a great
Rembrandt. Welcome back. Well, he was fired last week for lampooning the President of the United States, Rob Rogers, the celebrated editorial cartoonist of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It caused an uproar as debates about the limit of the First Amendment flared up in this country once again. Free speech, our cherished First Amendment, is a bedrock American value. How does it affect the art world, whether it's editorial cartoons or cake bakers who don't want to bake a cake for a gay couple, say? That is the question our Art Attack panel is pondering right now on the show as we welcome Lee Hamby of the Five and Dime Theater.
Good morning.
Artist and performer Ebony Payne English.
Hello.
Good morning. Shawana Brooks with the Jacksonville Makerspace.
Hello, Melissa.
And artist and writer Madeline Peck Wagner.
Good morning.
Okay, let's begin with the cartoonist. What do you guys think about that? This editorial cartoonist in Pittsburgh who was fired for cartoons criticizing President Trump.
Well, because I'm a writer and an artist, I tend to take a more absolutist stance on the First Amendment. I think that we are absolutely granted the right to say what we want. I do think that we can bump into structures where those opportunities might be pushed back against, as in the case of this cartoonist. I think it was inappropriate to fire him. And I don't think that by lampooning our leaders that we are harming them. In fact, I think we're doing valuable service by speaking truth to power. I will say that I believe specifically the image that got him fired was in direct correlation to the children who are being kept in cages. And it was indicative of the current administration's policy.
Right. Lee Hamby.
It's hard for me to speak on this subject of art because I'm more of a theater person and a word person. But again, I think it's... everybody's right, obviously, to do and say and create art as they wish, however they feel. So I think it's important for us to be able to share our feelings and our emotions through our art, for sure.
Shawana and Ebony, what about a cake maker who doesn't want to create art for a couple whose marriage he doesn't agree with?
These particular kind of situations, when they come up, are always hard for me because I can see sometimes the perspective from both ways. Certainly where I personally agree that if someone comes into your establishment and they order something, they should be able to get what they ordered. But also, I think that sometimes I'm the person who I don't want to go where I'm not necessarily wanted. How would I want to give my money and my service and my values to someone if they don't necessarily want to deal with me? Even as much as I might admire their skills, I wouldn't personally feel comfortable going into a business that was very clear that they didn't like people who looked like me. And I wouldn't be insistent on trying to propagate or give them any money. But I certainly do understand like the insistence and the necessity for people to be able to be valued in any space that they should be in.
So for me, I think that if we talk about freedom of expression and freedom of speech, it has to go across the board. So for business owners, their right to express the business that they intend to do and who they specifically prefer to serve, I think that that's absolutely allowed. However, that also comes with consequences because, yes, we have freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom to serve whomever we like as a business owner. And that also comes with consequences. So if you're on the wrong side of history with this, if you're a cake maker and you're refusing business to a billion-dollar consumer industry,
right?
You have to deal with the aftermath of that. And that is you're going to be refusing service to one couple, but actually denied business from millions. And so that's how I feel about it.
We could point to some other examples, including locally. Remember a few years ago when somebody who was tagging public spaces with graffiti / murals was initially arrested by police. And there was a debate about whether that was artistic expression or a crime.
And that had to do with it being, you know, property of the city or things like that. Am I correct?
Yeah.
So, you know, that does have, you know, a lot of thought to put into that is, and that could be a subject by itself is graffiti and public art. So that could be a whole different art attack, you know, segment right there in itself.
Mm-hmm. But that was what supporters saw was public art. What opponents saw was defacing public property.
And you get those two perspectives again, and I'm certainly someone who can understand those blurred lines. Certainly you want to see people out there, like, you know, Ebony said, being freedom, being expressive. But even within that context, then there becomes consequences. And sometimes once those things happen, it can open up a litany of responses that hopefully will still engage the public. And then now we have the ability to change those laws. Now it's different. They're now more encouraging, and they've been trying to do more public art in spaces because of things like that happened.
How do all of you see the art you create as being part of the tradition of the First Amendment? Free speech.
Well, I believe that history and education is passed on through art. So I consider myself a historian, a storyteller. I'm sharing my human experience with people, and it will outlive me. And so the way that I see it is I express it as truthfully as I can possibly get it out. As honest as I can be, that's how honest I am. Sometimes that's not pretty, and sometimes it's not flattering even to myself. But I want the humans that exist after I do to have an accurate understanding of what it means to be human and American and woman here during this time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd have to agree. I think that, you know, the truth is powerful. And when you apply that to yourself, that often means looking in the sort of the painful places, the places that hurt. In my own art, I make things that are kind of weird and not terribly aesthetically attractive. And I very tangibly see repercussions from that because my work doesn't really sell, which is fine because I can't necessarily make something else to fulfill an audience need. I would much rather speak my truth, which is this instance or currently is, you know, lumpy blobs of flesh.
Okay.
You know, for us at the Five and Dime, we don't we don't follow that model that a lot of other theaters follow with telling happy, family-friendly stories. And so we really tell, like you're saying about your visual art, we kind of tell those same stories on stage, and life is not always happy. And people really resonate with that. And we at the beginning had a little bit of an issue getting that audience right away, but now people are used to what we do and they love what we do. And it's not, of course, we do the fluff, we do the funny stuff, but for the most part, we tell these strong, important stories. Like right now, we're doing the Laramie Project, which mm-hmm. is a hard subject to talk about. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to us to be able to tell those strong, strong stories.
I mean, me personally, within my own art, people don't really know me as artist. They know me more for the expression that I do in service of other people's art as a curator. So trying to find, again, that balance within what they want to be able to tell and the story that I also see and envision. And hopefully that we find that truth within that perspective and that we can express it together in a way that you don't take away from what the artist wanted to say. But you also have to look for the perspective of the audience who's coming in to view that work, and putting all that together in a different environment with a lot of mixed mediums. It's just always really encouraging to see how that truth can be interpreted. No matter what people might see or read, they still have their own perspective.
Hmm. And we're talking about the First Amendment on today's Art Attack as we talk with Lee Hamby of the Five and Dime Theater, artist and performer Ebony Payne English, Shawana Brooks with Jacksonville Makerspace, and artist and author Madeline Peck Wagner. How do you see the local arts scene affecting these types of conversations? Because when you come on this show once a month, we talk about the local art and culture scene, and there's so many talented people doing great things. But I think often they can feel siloed and in their own little area. Do you see this community kind of unifying around some of these big issues as they have in other cities or not?
Absolutely.
I do too.
I would say that I think in the past few years, there's been a significant sway towards work that is invested in looking outwards as opposed to looking inwards. And I see people tackling big topics. Sometimes I see people making work that is similar to other larger artists, you know, larger meaning more well-known artists in the wider world. But I also see people really mining their own personal narratives and attempting to tell their truth. I just had a studio visit with an artist, Erin Kendrick, and her work right now is steeped both in ideas, we would say maybe of social justice, but also in this really sort of personal truth-telling in preparation for an upcoming show that she has.
Yeah.
And it was
mm-hmm.
it was an extraordinary marriage of ideology, because she's referencing specific writers and thinkers, and also her own narrative experience.
Hmm. I find us in the theater world, people not wanting to audition or perform in shows that don't have that strong story. People show up a lot more to the difficult, true to life stories than they do to your typical like Oklahoma Music Man, things like that. They really want to tell those stories. And yeah, it's been, and I say it was a trend a while ago, but that trend has continued to, like on Broadway, for example, to not always have the happy ending in these shows. And I think people enjoy those plays now because it allows them to see that they're not the only ones dealing with these issues.
And to your point, Melissa, and as much as we have seen, as Madeline says, that there has been some real collaboration amongst artists and visual artists and theater artists, and as Ebony would even say, like writers, what I still struggle a lot of times to see
30 seconds.
Is all that connection. I want to see more of us together and doing things between all those art disciplines that I know we can be uplifted to tell an even broader story.
Thank you for today's great discussion, Lee Hamby, Ebony Payne English, Shawana Brooks, and Madeline Peck Wagner, our Art Attack. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a moment, it's World Selfie Day. Our own Carrie Speckman is attempting to set a world selfie record. Can she do it? Answer next.
community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the Compassionate Guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
The House could vote on two immigration bills, but neither one appears likely to pass. Republicans are split and Democrats are angry over family separation.
We will not be cowed by taking little children hostage and then being demanded to vote for things that we think are harmful to the American people.
I'm Audie Cornish. What's next for immigration legislation this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vanity Fair writer Emily Jane Fox, who spent the past year investigating Ivanka Trump and her siblings. Her book, Born Trump, Inside America's First Family, includes intimate portraits of Trump's older children who didn't expect their father to win the 2016 election. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
President Trump has been forced into an about-face over his administration's policy of removing children from their parents at the border. It followed widespread public uproar that included every living former first lady calling the policy cruel and immoral.
These actions are an affront.
The latest on the border crisis and the power of the people closest to the president. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, today is the 2018 World Selfie Day. Here to tell us more, the selfie queen of Jacksonville herself. She's attempting to set a world record today. Carrie Speckman, a.k.a. The Spectator.
That's
good morning.
Me. Good morning.
Also with us, Christina Parrish Stone of Friends of Hemming Park and Tracy Rigdon of Eco Relics. Hey, guys. Good
Yay.
To see you.
Happy World Selfie Day.
Happy World Selfie Day. So this is the best thing in the world for you, Carrie Speckman.
Hello, I know.
The self-appointed selfie queen of Jacksonville.
Self-appointed says who? The people of social media say it, so therefore it's true.
And therefore it must be true.
It's official.
So today you're going to attempt to break the world record for most selfies taken at one time.
Correct.
What's going to be happening
here? The record is 96, and so we will need at least 97 people there with their phones, all taking pictures of themselves, hence selfie, at the same time. And then we have people who have to provide evidence, like Tracy Collins will be there recording it. And
someone to document the selfie extravaganza.
Yes, especially because we're breaking it. That makes it even more challenging.
Okay, this is going down at noon or 12:30 in Hemming Park, Christina?
Yes, we need people to be there at 12:30 so that we can give specific instructions, and then the photograph will happen at 12:45.
Wow. And will you go in the Guinness book if you make it?
This is world records or recordsetter.com.
Okay.
Which is also a world, it's another version. Guinness, do you know what it takes to get in Guinness? Money.
I guess more
time.
Than what we're doing today.
Well, it's still a world record, man.
Still a world record.
Still a world record.
Tracy Rigdon of Eco Relics, such a great store in the city. What's Eco Relics' role in all of the selfie madness?
I put the whole thing together basically with Christina and with Carrie. We do a lot of charity events over at Eco, and so I'm always looking for fun things to do. I found National Selfie Day, and the first person I thought of. Of course,
Miss Take Care herself.
That was it.
That's right.
So we put it together.
So people just, if they come out today, they can participate in they can just take a selfie with everybody else there all at the same time. Is
absolutely.
That the idea?
Absolutely. And donate to the charities.
Yes, right. I Still Matter and Where's the Sunshine. Also, if we do break the record, everyone who participates will get a certificate. So they will actually be a world record holder themselves.
They'll even get to meet Christina Parrish Stone.
The queen.
If you're the selfie queen, Christina is the queen of Springfield,
yes,
as I like to
she
say.
Is.
And I think I've moved on to being
the queen of Hemming Park.
She's the queen of Hemming Park.
I'm not sure queen is the right title, but something to do with Hemming Park.
Empress. How's that?
Oh, I like that.
Well, this is really cool. And so this is happening at 12:30. There will be food trucks and prizes and music.
Special guests. And we're doing a drawing. For everyone who participates, we're giving away gift certificates to Blue Bamboo, European Street. We've got all kinds of eco relics also. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, so it's just going to be a lot of fun. Now, I think most of us have taken a selfie at one time or another. What do you think? What would you say to those listening who don't like the selfie trend? They think it's narcissistic.
That's what I say.
That's what you say. What about you guys?
I'm not a big fan of selfies myself. Carrie has forced me to be in more than a couple. Yep. I'd like a couple of tips from Carrie on how to take a good selfie.
Oh, yeah. Let's share a few selfie tips before the end of the hour.
One, you got to hold it up in the air. That's why you always see people. Remember when Sally Struthers was here?
Yes,
and she would not. She had to have someone take her picture because she has to have it so high because she's short.
She was short.
Kind of, you know.
So hold the phone up
hold
high.
Hold it up high. You got to get the good lighting. And sometimes you just have to kind of, I'm doing all this like people can see it.
And of course, you have an opinion about selfie sticks.
Oh, don't get started with
selfies. Don't use selfie sticks?
People do, but to me, then that's not a selfie. I mean, it is, but you might as well just
get the old-fashioned way.
Because the fun.
Old-fashioned. We've been doing this for a few years.
The fun of the selfie, to me, is the composition, like how you have to have everybody kind of squeeze in. I remember one of yours is one of my favorites because it was so horrible. It was you and like... Former Mayor Delaney and somebody else.
It was me, Annette Glover, Tim Cost, and John Delaney.
Yes.
It was like the worst selfie ever taken.
Somebody's eyebrows.
I think
and
I remember
like
that.
An eyeball here.
I was tired. And I'm not you.
But that's what makes it fun. See, it's not fun if like, oh, hey, let me pose here and take. That's not fun.
I know.
I don't think.
Well, you really are the selfie queen of Jacksonville. So people should take their tips from you.
They should.
And they can come out and meet you today along with Christina, Tracy, lots of other fun folks at this big event on World Selfie Day.
If the mayor is listening, he's been invited.
Invite the mayor. He might walk out from City Hall and be part of it.
I'll go in there and drag him out if I have
to. Carrie Speckman is going to attempt to break the world record for most selfies taken at one time at 12:30 today on this World Selfie Day in downtown Hemming Park. I wish you luck. I know you're going to do
it. Thank you. Of course.
And thanks so much to Christina Parrish Stone of Friends of Hemming Park and Tracy Rigdon, the creator of this idea from Eco Alex, going to be lots of fun downtown today, and have fun while you're there, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Next on 1A, how will families separated at the border be reunited? I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable, talking about the biggest stories of the week. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, just keep listening for Electro Lounge, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.